All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive here on the LexPlug podcast. Today, we're going to be digging into something pretty interesting in contract law, and we're going to do it by looking at a specific case. It's called Julius Castle Restaurant v. Payne.
Oh, yeah, this is a good one. A California case.
Yeah. So basically, what we're going to try to understand here is like how much weight do promises that are made, you know, verbally before a contract is even written, how much weight do those promises carry if a dispute ends up in court, especially if someone claims like, hey, I was tricked, I was defrauded into signing this thing.
Yeah. And, you know, Julius Castle is a good illustration of this classic tension in contract law, right?
Yeah.
Where you have this idea that like once it's written down and signed, that's the final word. But then you also have this idea that, well, you shouldn't be able to, you know, lie to someone to get them to sign a contract.
Right. So we're going to be focusing on a really key legal concept called the parole evidence rule. And specifically, we're going to be looking at its fraud exception.
Right.
So for everyone listening out there, the big sort of takeaway we're aiming for today is that like even those spoken promises, those things that happen before anything is written down, those things can have like actual legal consequences. And that's especially true if one party, you know, claims that they were intentionally misled.
Exactly.
We're looking at a dispute over a lease for a restaurant, like a real and actual historic restaurant here.
Oh, wow.
In San Francisco.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess the big question here, like the core of what we're looking at is, can a party use those verbal promises, those assurances, you know, as evidence in court to prove that they were basically tricked into signing the agreement in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, because often like what's said beforehand might actually contradict what ends up in the written contract.
Right.
So that's what we're going to be unpacking.
All right. So let's set the stage here. What exactly happened between this restaurant, Julius Castle Restaurant, we'll just call it JCRI, and the landlords, Payne and Top of the Rock Castle LLC? Like, what started this whole thing?
Okay. So back in 2013, we've got JCRI.
Mm-hmm.
They were led by these two guys, Charles Stinson and John Bongean.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they decide to lease this property, this historic restaurant property from Payne.
Mm.
And here's where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
The tenants claim that before they signed anything, Payne made all these verbal promises, you know, saying that the property was in great condition, that he would take care of any repairs, you know, the kind of stuff that would make you feel good about signing a lease.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's kind of you know, standard procedure, right? Like when you're trying to rent something out, you're going to try to paint it in the best light possible.
Right.
But there's got to be a catch here.
Right.
Like what did the actual written lease agreement, like what did the document say about who was responsible for what?
Yeah. So this is where it gets sticky. Like you said, often those initial conversations, you know, they paint a rosy picture,
mm-hmm.
but the written lease told a different story.
Mm-hmm.
It said that the tenants, so JCRI, they were completely responsible for all maintenance, all repairs, everything. And to really hammer that point home, they had something called an integration clause in the lease.
And what exactly is an integration clause?
Oh, right, yeah. So an integration clause is basically a statement in the contract that says, look, this written document, this is the be-all and end-all. It basically overrides any previous conversations, agreements, whatever. It says, this piece of paper is what counts.
This piece of paper is all that matters clause.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, so JCRI, they sign this lease. They move into this historic restaurant. They're probably pretty excited, right? Like they're ready to open up shop.
Yeah, you would think.
But did reality match up to, you know, those initial like rosy promises?
So according to the tenants, no. Not at all. They claimed that soon after they moved in, all these problems started popping up, like issues with the property, equipment malfunctions, you know, the basic stuff you need to run a restaurant.
Yeah.
And remember, Payne had verbally promised to handle all these things.
Yeah.
But surprise, surprise, they weren't addressed. And the restaurant, you know, it struggled. They couldn't really operate properly. And in the end, they had to shut down after just 6 months. Imagine that. You put your heart and soul into this venture and, you know, it all falls apart because of broken promises.
Yeah, that's got to be like super frustrating, right? You think you're getting one thing and
absolutely,
it turns out to be a completely different story.
And this is where the law steps in, mm-hmm. you know, to try to yeah. right some wrongs.
Right.
Provide some recourse.
Okay. So what did JCRI do? They obviously weren't just going to walk away, right?
No, they didn't. They decided to sue Payne and they alleged fraud. They claimed that those initial promises he made, you know, about the restaurant's condition, they weren't just like optimistic sales talk, they were deliberate lies designed to, like, lure them into signing the lease.
Wow.
And here's the key thing. At the trial, the court allowed JCRI to actually present evidence of those pre-contract promises, those verbal promises.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
To support their whole fraud argument.
And how did the jury see it? What was the outcome of the trial?
Well, the jury sided with the tenants.
Really?
They believed them. They found in favor of JCRI on their fraud claim and awarded them damages. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they won. But as you might expect, Payne wasn't happy with this outcome. He decided to appeal the decision. And that's where things get really legally interesting.
Yeah, so this is where it gets really into the weeds, right? The appeal.
Right, exactly.
So what was, like, the main legal issue at the heart of this appeal? And how does this whole parole evidence rule, how does that come into play?
Okay, so the big question the appeals court had to grapple with was whether this parole evidence rule, you know, whether it should have blocked those verbal promises from even being considered in the first place. Like, could the trial court even hear about them?
Mm-hmm.
Especially since those promises seemed to, you know, completely contradict what was clearly written in the lease agreement. So the parole evidence rule under California law, it's found in the California Code of Civil Procedure, Section 1856. And it basically says that you can't introduce evidence of prior agreements, you know, whether those agreements were spoken or written, to contradict a written contract that's supposed to be the complete agreement.
Okay.
Like, you know, imagine the chaos if every contract dispute just devolved into people arguing about he said, she said, totally undermining what they actually signed.
Yeah.
It's all about having certainty, finality. You know, you sign the paper, that's it.
Right.
So that's the parole evidence rule in a nutshell.
Right.
But there's a catch, like you mentioned earlier. There's this exception for fraud.
Oh, right.
And this is also spelled out in the same section of the law, 1856G.
Okay.
And it very clearly states that you can bring in evidence to prove fraud, even if it contradicts the written agreement. The whole idea is you shouldn't be able to hide behind a contract if you trick someone into signing it.
That makes sense. So how does this Bank of America v. Pendergrass case, how does that fit into all of this?
Yeah, so Pendergrass, this case from 1935, it kind of muddied the waters a bit. It threw a wrench into things. Basically, it put a big limitation on the fraud exception.
Mm.
It said that, sure, you can use evidence of a fraudulent promise, but only if it didn't contradict what was in the written contract.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, if Payne had promised to repair everything, but the lease clearly put the responsibility on the tenants, well, under the Pendergrass rule, the court might not have even been allowed to hear about that promise. So it was kind of a catch-22. You could only use evidence of fraud if it didn't really challenge the written agreement.
That does seem a little counterintuitive. So how did this, like, thinking about fraud and contracts, how did that change?
Right. And that's where this really important 2013 case, River Island Cold Storage v. Fresno Madera Production Creditus, comes into play.
Okay.
River Island tackled that Pendergrass limitation head on. And they basically said, no, that's not how it works. Like, in a big move, they overruled Pendergrass.
Wow.
And the big takeaway from River Island is this. The court can now actually look at those pre-contract conversations, even if they completely contradict the signed agreement, if there's an allegation of fraud.
So it sounds like River Island really, like, shifted the legal landscape here.
Huge shift.
So how did the California Supreme Court in River Island, like, how did they justify that change?
They basically went back to the law itself. They looked at that section, 1856G, and said, look, there's nothing in here about this Pendergrass limitation. Pendergrass added something that wasn't there. And they emphasized that the fraud exception should apply to all fraud cases, regardless of whether the verbal promise contradicts the written words.
Mm.
You can't just sweep fraud under the rug because it clashes with the contract.
Right.
The court was basically saying, we need to look at the whole picture.
Okay, so this brings us back to Julius Castle, right? So how did the court use that, like, new understanding from River Island in this specific case?
Right. So Julius Castle, this is where it all comes together. They lean heavily on the River Island precedent.
Okay.
And they uphold the trial court's decision to let in that evidence of Payne's verbal promises about the condition of the property and his promises to repair. And, you know, these promises went totally against what was written in the lease, which, you know, said JCRI was responsible.
All right, right.
But because of River Island, those promises were allowed because of that whole fraud exception.
Yeah.
So yeah, Julius Castle is basically River Island in action.
That makes sense. So what were, like, the specific reasons the Julius Castle court gave for siding with that River Island approach?
Okay, so they laid out three main reasons. First, they really hammered home the importance of the plain language of the law. You know, they were like, look, the law itself doesn't say anything about limiting the fraud exception just because the oral promise contradicts the written agreement.
Well, yeah.
They're basically saying, let's stick to what the law actually says. And they agreed with River Island that the Pendergrass rule was like this extra thing that judges had added on, and it wasn't really justified.
Gotcha. So they're really focused on like the actual words of the law.
Right? Yeah. It's all about going back to the core of the law, stripping away any unnecessary additions. And their second reason for siding with River Island was that they rejected Payne's argument that, you know, River Island should only be used to protect like the less sophisticated parties.
Okay.
Payne basically tried to argue that, you know, JCRA, they were a business, they should have known better.
Oh, and just
but the Julius Castle Court, they shut that down pretty hard. They were like, no, fraud is fraud. It doesn't matter if you're a big shot business or just a regular person. Everyone deserves protection from being tricked into a contract.
Right, right. It's like, you know, sophistication shouldn't be a shield for bad behavior.
Exactly.
Okay, so no matter how experienced you are, you can still claim fraud if you were lied to. What was the third point?
Okay, so their third big point was all about this concept of reasonable reliance. Like, even though the court can now hear evidence of these contradictory promises, the person claiming fraud, in this case, JCRI, they still have to prove that they reasonably relied on those promises. They can't just say, oh, he told me this, and automatically win.
Makes sense.
It has to be believable, you know, under the circumstances.
Right.
So in Julius Castle, JCRI argued that, you know, their reliance was reasonable because Payne had hidden how bad the condition of the property actually was. Like, even though they'd inspected it, they couldn't have known the full extent of the problems.
Oh, okay. So it's not just about the contradiction between what was said and what was written. It's also about the context, about whether it was reasonable for the other party to believe those verbal promises.
Exactly. And to make it even clearer, like, how courts should handle these kind of situations, after River Island, the Julius Castle Court actually pointed to five factors. These factors are super helpful in figuring out if this verbal evidence should even be considered in fraud cases.
Okay, so what are those five factors?
All right, so the first question is, do the oral promises actually contradict what's written in the agreement? And, you know, after River Island, the answer can be yes.
Right.
Unlike under Pendergrass.
Right.
The second question is, was it reasonable for the person to rely on those promises?
Yeah.
You know, think about that circumstance, the whole context.
Okay.
In Julius Castle, they said, well, you know, he hid how bad things really were. So yeah, it was reasonable for them to believe him.
Right.
The third factor is, how sophisticated were the parties involved? Like, were they experienced business people or not? This isn't as big of a deal anymore after River Island, but it's still something courts might look at. The fourth factor is, did the parties have enough time to really think about and negotiate the contract before they signed it? And the fifth factor, do the alleged oral promises make sense? Like, do they fit in with the overall deal?
Okay, so it sounds like the focus has really shifted. Like, it's not just about strictly interpreting the written contract anymore, right? It's more about looking at the whole situation, especially when someone is claiming fraud.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Courts are now more willing to look beyond just the words in the paper and consider the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, especially if there's evidence that someone might have been intentionally tricked into signing.
So Julius Castle, building on what River Island did, what are like the big practical takeaways here for contract law in California? Like, what should lawyers and businesses be thinking about after this?
There are a few really important things to keep in mind. First, like, strategically, when you're thinking about legal strategy, fraud claims, they have a lot more weight now. You know, those integration clauses, those like, this is the whole deal statements in contracts. Well, they're not as much of a shield against fraud claims anymore.
Interesting. So that standard clause that everyone throws into their contracts, it's not as ironclad as it used to be.
Yeah, not when someone's claiming fraud.
Yeah.
So that's the first takeaway. The second takeaway is that, you know, for people who draft contracts, lawyers, they need to be a lot more careful now.
Yeah.
Like, just throwing in that standard merger clause, you might not cut it anymore.
Yeah.
If you want to really avoid problems down the line, you have to address those verbal promises directly. Like, write in the written agreement, like, maybe include them as warranties, you know, so there's no confusion.
Yeah, that sounds like a smart move.
And the third big takeaway is that juries are probably going to be more involved in these types of cases. Because courts are allowing this mix of evidence, you know, what was said versus what was written. So juries are going to have to listen to all that, weigh it, and decide who to believe.
Right.
And that could make things a little bit more unpredictable. You know, it's not just about black and white contract interpretation anymore.
So, like, for attorneys out there who are advising their clients, in California specifically, what's, like, the big advice, the bottom line after this whole Julius Castle situation?
The number one piece of advice is document everything. If your client is making promises or assurances during negotiations, get them in writing, you know? Make them formal parts of the contract. And always, always remind your clients that even though a solid contract is super important, those things they talked about before, those verbal agreements, they can still come back, especially if there's a chance of a fraud claim. Like the court said, and this is a quote from an earlier case, the parole evidence rule was never intended to be a shield for fraud. And that really sums up the whole idea here.
Yeah, that's a really powerful statement. It shows that, you know, we want contracts to be solid, but we also don't want people to get away with lying and deceiving others.
Right, exactly. You have to balance these competing ideas.
And Julius Castle, that whole story, it really shows how these, you know, legal concepts actually play out in real life and how they can have real consequences, like that restaurant shutting down.
Oh, for sure. And to kind of bring it all together, just to clarify for everyone listening, Julius Castle really hammers home that, like, River Island was a game changer.
Yeah.
And it applies even in situations where you have experienced business people making a deal.
Yeah.
You know, not just like regular folks.
Right.
In Julius Castle, they specifically pointed out that those promises Payne made, they went directly against what was in the lease.
Yeah.
Like, both parties couldn't be solely responsible for repairs. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
But because of that fraud exception, like River Island made clear, those promises could still be considered by the court.
So it's not just about what's written in the contract. It's about the whole context and whether there was an intent to deceive.
Absolutely.
But even with all that, it's important to remember that the person who's claiming fraud, they still have to prove that they actually relied on those false statements and that their reliance was reasonable.
Right. Like, just because evidence is allowed doesn't mean they automatically win the case.
Right. They still have to convince the court.
And, like the court said, quoting an earlier case, it was never intended that the parole evidence rule should be used as a shield to prevent the proof of fraud. And Julius Castle really ensures that this idea remains a core principle in California contract law.
Okay, so the main takeaway for everyone listening, the big thing to remember from our deep dive into Julius Castle Restaurant v. Payne is this. In California, especially after River Island, and as we see very clearly in Julius Castle, even if you have a written contract with an integration clause, those verbal promises, if they were fraudulent, can still come back to bite you.
Absolutely. A written contract is important, but it's not a free pass to lie and deceive people.
Right.
Anyone involved in contracts, whether you're writing them, arguing about them in court, or just trying to understand what your rights are, you have to know about the parole evidence rule and its fraud exception, and how cases like River Island and Julius Castle have shaped how it's applied.
Yeah, definitely some important things to think about. And it makes you wonder, right? Like, how is this going to affect how people negotiate contracts in the future?
Yeah.
Will everyone start documenting everything even more carefully because of this, you know, increased chance that those pre-contract conversations could become an issue in court?
It's a really fascinating area of law. And Julius Castle, it's just a great example of how these legal principles actually play out in the real world. So Thanks to everyone for joining us on this deep dive. It's been a pleasure. It's always good to dig into these landmark cases and see how they shape the legal landscape.
All right. And we'll see you all on the next deep dive.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.